second edition of the Planet Podcast.
Second? Where was I for the first? Well, oh, that's right. I wasn't here.
You were out of town. I'm sorry. You were at that convention that we don't speak about.
Yes.
Which, by the way, one day we are going to have to speak about because the expenses are coming in, and I just don't understand what some of these charges are.
It was a serial convention.
Right.
And that's a very dark Sandman reference, so we won't even go there. Okay. Anyway, carry on.
All right. Thank you. As you can tell, I am Jay Marcus, joined by the ever wonderful, fantastic, and witty, charming, and I ran out of adjectives because the check just didn't clear. Brian Zeno.
That is me.
Also of the Podwits podcast, the Four Color Fanboys podcast. Where the hell else can people hear you?
Wahoo! A Sergeant Fury podcast tracking the history of Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, and that one is at furycast.podwits.com and also on iTunes.
He's really good at the plug. He's very subtle, but he gets right in there. That's fantastic. Well done, sir.
Because we forgot to mention
that Four Color Fanboys is also at fourcolor.podwits.com.
Podwits.com, yeah. And also on iTunes.
And of course, I join Brian. Brian joins me and Dion Baia over at the Podwits podcast.
The old original Mothercast.
That's right. Because we are part of the Podwits podcast network. A fine network, if I might add. We really enjoy the people in charge of that who sign our checks.
Yes, exactly.
The Planet podcast, this is only episode 2. So for those of you who don't know, who can't tell by the cover art or the website that you found it on or the description.
Or the incessant piped in sound of wind.
Yes. Well, I thought I shut that window. Damn it. All right. Okay. My weathering is not as good as I thought. My weather stripping is not as good as I thought.
You know, the sort of George Reeve sort of thing going on.
It is, which, by the way, was just so cool to this day. But anyway, back to pulling it back. So this is the preeminent Podwits branded Superman related podcast.
Yes.
Where I will be your guide in the 76 now years, so almost 77 years, of Superman history, dating back from 1938 to present day. My disclaimer, which I'm going to every month until
until the super cows come home.
Seriously, is for those of you who've heard me on the Podwits podcast, you know I love the Richard Donner Superman films. I'm a big fan of Christopher Reeve's portrayal. I'm kind of anti New 52. I like a Superman who wears his trunks on the outside, but I am not. That's not what this podcast is about. We are actually going to be looking at the various ups and downs of his history in various forms of media.
Mm-hmm.
Last month, if you were with us,
felt like a week.
It would
time,
really
the
does.
Time it just flies.
I see what you did there.
Thank
He's
you.
Good. He's really good. We got to double his pay. Full 50 cents. last month, thank you. We were with. I was joined by Dion Baia, and he and I started our exploration of the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons from the 40s. But joined now by Brian Zeno, will be looking at Superman in the comics.
Yes, the printed Superman.
The printed Superman. And I guess what better way to get this ball rolling than to start at the very beginning? I hear it's
Action
a very good place to start.
Number one.
Printed in, or released in June 1938.
With a cover date of August 1938, I believe.
No, I thought it said June. Mm. I could be wrong.
You're right. June 1938.
That's why I'm the Podwits expert.
Yes, I know, you're correct, sir.
I knew that.
That's why I'm just the sidekick, and I only get 25 cents.
Per appearance, though. That's
yes,
the good
exactly.
news. It's not per year. It's per appearance. We're pay or play. Action Comics number one. Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, we could spend an entire podcast by itself getting into the origins of the character, where he came from, the years that it took, at one point he was a villain, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But That really is another story. We'll start with Action Comics number one, as presented to us. And as origin stories go for a character, it's exceptionally bare bones. Like, it's literally, his origin is one page. One page.
One page. And it's the Action Comics version of his origin is actually different from, I mean, here we are in the year 2015, and we've all grown up with Superman as part of the fabric. You sort of get used to a certain version of the Superman origin. It's very interesting to see how different this one-page origin is from what we all thought we knew.
A lot of people for years, and I can really actually speak, I promise, a lot of people for many years said that really everything you need to know about his origin, everything that sort of came afterwards that was expanded upon or embellished or whatever, really came off of this page for the most part. Obviously the powers thing almost
which were different
it's almost unrecognizable now.
You
know, they say he can leap an eighth of a mile.
Right.
And hurdle a 20-story building.
Yeah, he's not even flying yet.
Yeah, he can raise tremendous weights, and it's really as ambiguous as that, run faster than an express train, and this is my personal favorite, and nothing short of a bursting shell could penetrate his skin.
Now, I just want to tell her, I personally would like our listeners to remember that phrase. So once again, as from Action Comics number one, seriously, remember that it said, nothing less than a bursting shell could penetrate his skin.
Yes.
So as at his inception, it was established that in fact a bursting shell could penetrate Superman's skin.
Correct.
Okay, so I just want that on the record because we're going to come back to that in a few minutes.
Now, having said that, this is such an incredibly stripped down version. There is Krypton is not mentioned by name. As a matter of fact, you technically, if you look at the panel itself, you don't even see the rocket ship leave.
Well, actually, you do.
It's sort of
zooming away to the upper right of the panel there.
But I mean, and then in the middle panel, it's just sitting there.
Yeah, it's sitting there on Earth, where it is about to get discovered by a passing motorist.
Yes,
one singular.
Mm-hmm.
Singular.
And by the way, at no point, even as you continue the story, the Kents are not mentioned by name either.
No, no. As a matter of fact, the first time we get a name for him at all is in, I'm not sure exactly how to number these panels, given how oddly they're laid out, but we're at the end of the second row of panels, there's a text-only panel that says early, comma, Clark decided he must turn his tape. And that's the first, at no point do they say he was named Clark or whatever, just early, Clark decided, and so was created Superman.
Correct. Now, by the way, this is the most and this leads to the most fascinating part of the origin story, as far as I'm concerned, is that, I mean, say what you will about whatever came afterwards, the wording of this particular panel is intriguing to me.
Okay.
Because you have, and thus was created Superman, which acknowledges that Superman is a creation. And then on the very next panel, the last panel on that first page, a scientific explanation of Clark Kent's amazing strength.
Yes.
Which, to my mind, if you were to read that whole page exactly as presented, to me that means that everybody that came after was a little wrong or a little off, and that Clark Kent is the guy, and Superman is the persona that he created.
You know,
to do what he can do.
I'm not going to get into it now, but that is definitely interesting to me because I have said in the past on many occasions that one difference between the traditional DC comics portrayal of superheroes in general and the Marvel approach to superheroes that was started in 1961 with the actual advent of Marvel Comics is that in DC Comics, the character is Superman or Batman or whoever, and that their quote-unquote secret identities, Clark Kent or Bruce Wayne or whoever, is just that, a secret identity of Superman. Superman is who he is.
Right.
Clark Kent is the disguise, so to speak.
Sure.
And it's very much, I find, to be the opposite in Marvel Comics, where say, Peter Parker. Peter Parker is who he is. Spider-Man is the disguise. And I find that to be very a very interesting difference between the approaches of the two large, you know, companies. But anyway, the point is, that just brings us back here to what you're saying, how in the very, very beginning, the focus and the reference to not Superman, but Clark Kent is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I carry with me, and again, it's funny because early on I always just thought of it that way, that he was, you know, raised as Clark Kent. He was Clark Kent, and he became Superman as a response to what he can do. And everyone just sort of said, no, he was always Superman, and Clark Kent was just, whatever. But it's funny that it took years before I read this page. And mm-hmm. I read this exact panel because, of course, you know, it's very rare outside of the 1940s, for example, the very first thing you would read is the origin story, the original mm-hmm. origin story for Superman. It's very rare that that's your introduction to the character. So when I finally did read it, I went, okay, good to know.
Now, I have three observations regarding this original one-page origin.
Sure.
Number one is that this page definitely gives the impression, as you point out, the Kents are not involved at all. Mm-hmm. It definitely gives the impression that he was raised entirely in an orphanage.
Right.
That's interesting to me. Number two and three both come from that last panel, the scientific explanation
yes.
of Clark Kent's amazing.
Which is a lot of fun when you read it.
Right. Now, one is that it says in the text part on the side that Kent had come from a planet whose inhabitants' physical structure was millions of years advanced of our own. And
yes.
I'm thinking to myself, I don't actually know what that means. Physical structure being millions of years advanced. I mean, I'm sort of just accepting it on face value, but it just
right.
sort of struck me as a little bit of hand-wavium.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah.
And then the second part is the fact that the big banner at the top of the panel promises the reader
mm-hmm.
a scientific explanation of Clark Kent's amazing strength. And when you take it all down, basically these quote-unquote scientific explanation basically is, well, insects can do it, which strikes me as neither scientific nor an explanation. Discuss amongst yourselves.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's very true. I think, honestly, by way of quote-unquote scientific explanation, what they're saying is there's precedent for for somebody to have these proportionate abilities
mm-hmm.
Without having been bitten by a radioactive ant or a radioactive grasshopper, respectively.
Yes, exactly.
But, no, you're right. There isn't, like, they don't get into the mechanism of it or what it is exactly that makes that happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know,
no actual explaining going on here.
But I guess for their purposes, and I guess for the slightly more juvenile readers that they expect to have had, I guess that'll do.
Yes.
Go ahead. Look. I swear, grasshoppers. I promise you that totally works.
Now.
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to give you a bit of a break there. If you want to cut this bit out, you can. I'm about to go slightly blue. Edit this stretch out, and I'll go back into it, and you can either edit the whole bit out or just edit this bit out to run it together.
Okay.
And speaking of juvenile,
yes.
I did have one other thought, which is perhaps a tad more salty.
Yes.
But also here it says, upon reaching maturity,
yes.
the people of his race became gifted with titanic strength. And now I'm thinking to myself, that makes it sound an awful lot like they hit, I don't know what, at 18 or 21 or whatever,
yeah.
and suddenly, boom, they wake up one day with the great strength. And then it occurs to me, wait just a minute here, there's something, and I won't get into too much detail, but there are some things that adolescents do, perhaps adolescent
yes.
males do rather
yeah.
a lot. And if you suddenly woke up with titanic strength,
yes.
I can imagine that being a somewhat traumatic coming of age.
Perhaps, but I think that the good news is that one would hope that at the same time you reach that titanic strength, you also reach your titanic invulnerability. And so
okay,
you don't accidentally
so bursting shelf, the whole bursting shelf thing.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay,
yeah,
understood. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. So, no, good, but excellent point. By the way, I got to tell you, thank God that the people of Superman's race, I guess, are recognizable from an early point, because there's this great shot in the top of little baby Superman lifting a armchair over his head, and yes. he still has the spit curl in the front, which
yes.
I think is great.
Yes.
That's all he's got. He doesn't have any other hair, but he's got this little spit curl. So evidently, it's good to know that that stuck with him through, you know, when he reached
everything,
maturity.
Yeah.
It also gained strength and stayed.
Mm-hmm. the strongest spit curl in the universe.
It truly is. So then from that point, from this one page, mm-hmm. we hit a story already in progress as Superman is racing to save Superman already. We don't even have to get into his first appearance. He's here. Superman is racing to save the life of a woman who's on death row. He has proof that she was falsely accused, and he has the real murderess in his hands, and he goes barging into the governor's mansion and
with the governor's literally murderous butler.
Yeah, oh my God, yes. I mean, it's well, you got to admit, at least the guy is committed to his job. And by the way, waving the dude over his head with one mm-hmm. hand, which you know, God, what a way to make a first impression on anybody.
I know, right?
And by the way, why exactly does the governor have a steel door to his bedroom? Lord, I guess a lot of people try to break in.
This governor, I mean, like, this governor really doesn't want – he really wants his night sleep undisturbed.
He likes his beauty sleep. And if you look at him, you could see he doesn't get quite enough of it. But
oh, and by the way, it's not his bedroom. It's his sleeping room.
Yes.
Is anybody else here getting, like, you know, Kang the Conqueror kind of vibe going on here?
Mildly.
I have come to govern your planet. I will be Governor Clintone. And this will be
my
sleeping room.
And by the way, I have a little tiny clock that appears in the lower right-hand corner while things are going on. No, actually, that was a great narrative point. They actually have a clock ticking.
Hangs in the balance, it says. I have to say, if going by this, now I do not know how much of a groundbreaker this particular magazine was meant to be. I mean, it was the first issue of Action Comics, and obviously it was the first appearance of Superman, who was a very new kind of adventure hero at that time in 1938. But from the point of view of the creators, Siegel and Schuster, of the editor, Vincent Sullivan, and National Publications, I don't know exactly if they were aware that this was, that they were putting something really new and groundbreaking out, or if from their point of view, this was just the launch of another pulp illustrated adventure type series. But the reason I say that is because if this is in any way representative of what else was going on in illustrated adventure storytelling in the late 30s, and apparently I'm going to assume also that this is meant for children, because there's an ad inside the front cover that tells its readers to, quote, take out your crayons and color the first page of one of the features and send it into them in order to win a prize. So that, to me, leads me to believe that this was, in fact, intended for children.
Sounds right.
I bring all this up is because if this is, in fact, intended for children, well, this is some pretty dark and serious story material for children. So, a wrongly accused murderess going to the electric chair, a life hangs in the balance and could be snuffed out unjustly in mere minutes. And I'm thinking to myself, that's giving kids a lot more credit than they tend to give them these days.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, gee, and you're right. In these days, first of all, I mean, it's almost sacrilegious that a gun would get shot.
That's true.
It's a, you know, by one human being to seemingly another. I mean, if you know, superpowers with laser beams, whatever, one thing. But this is your introduction to the character, and another kid just whips out a gun and shoots him point blank. You know, and this is supposed to be law and order, no less. So you're right. It does get pretty dark. And I'm, you know, it's funny. A lot of creators nowadays. Especially, I can mention it, I'm not criticizing it, when the New 52 was launched, there was a desire to make the younger days of Superman appear very much like this Superman, which they label as being like a social crusader, you know, fighting for the rights of the everyman. And going back and reading this, it's not the impression that I'm getting per se. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know that that was necessarily a specific goal that they had in mind in writing him that way, so mm-hmm. much as this was the sort of problem they could wrap their heads around. In an initial adventure story, I think once the character gets a life of its own, you can start to world build further than that and say, oh, mad scientists and whatever. And also, those were also very reflective, you know, as the mad scientist phase came in, which led to Luthor and mm-hmm. So forth. Those
the Ultra Humanite, yeah. Who was sort of like Luthor 0.1,
right?
You know, like the proto Luthor.
But all of those came from, you know, the scientific crazes,
yes.
that happened later on. So Superman was very reflective of the kinds of stories that were popular at the time. So
sure.
So I don't know that he was necessarily meant to be a social crusader so much as these were the kinds of stories that were popular, and you put him in that kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of quasi-detective. I mean, there's, as the story progresses, you know, okay, so he saves a woman from being, you know, wrongly executed for murder, and then from mm-hmm. there, you know, he has this, you know, he goes after a wife beater, who,
yes.
by the way, I gotta tell you, this has gotta be, I feel so sorry for this woman, who's being beaten, because mm-hmm. This has to be the longest beating in the history of man, because he's at Clark Kent at the Daily Planet is running through the newsroom, and there's a hurry, Kent, a phoned tip that there's a wife beating, which, by the way, don't call the cops, call the newspaper.
Right, exactly.
And so there's a beating already in progress,
and a wife beating is news.
Yep. Well, clearly, I guess. And then what? Oh, ouch. And then
No. I mean that generally. Like, I mean, look, I feel for it, and it is absolutely a criminal matter that needs to be addressed, and
sure.
I am in no way, shape,
no,
or form saying it. But
I
I'm saying it doesn't seem that, like, that would rise to the level of the attention of a newspaper.
Right. You would think that, again, cops would be the first one you call. So then Clark has enough time to change, get there, because remember, mm-hmm. he's moving faster than an express train, but he's not necessarily, you know, supersonic, and mm-hmm. so, and then he has time to get there. So how long was this woman being beaten?
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
a long beating. But he does get there, and in great maneuver, the guy mm-hmm. who's beating his wife faints in his arms.
Mm-hmm.
How sweet is that? Which then leads us to Lois and Clark's first terrible date,
mm-hmm.
Which now, again, this is the thing that sets up the cover image, that glorious cover image of,
yes.
Superman hefting the car over his head.
I had never read this story before. I had only ever read the first page origin.
Mm-hmm.
So as in preparation for this episode of this podcast, I read the whole story, and I was actually pleasantly surprised
mm-hmm.
to see that the cover image actually appeared in the comic story itself. I had always sort of assumed that it was just a random kind of image meant to sell the magazine. I didn't know it was from the story.
No, it's believe me when I tell you, I again, I encountered that very young, even because I used to look at the comics before I'd read them. And so, yeah, seeing the image sort of duplicated, like, oh my God. And it really sets you up. Imagine if this was like your first comic. It sets you up for disappointment almost for the rest of your comic reading
mm-hmm.
History, because it's so rare afterwards that the cover image is actually in the comic, let alone for a long time, that it has anything to do with what's in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like there was that long period of time where the image cover image just was random. It was almost like pinup art that you
mm-hmm.
put on the front and the end. So yeah, it was insane. And it's such a great, but I'm wondering, you know, in hindsight being 2020 and not knowing for sure, if it were me, if I saw the inside and I saw that image, I'd be like, that's a cover.
Mm-hmm.
That's clearly mm-hmm. a cover. Like, well, do that again, bigger.
Yeah.
And make it.
And you can tell they did it again. They didn't
yeah.
just reprint the panel because, not just because of the aspect ratio and all that,
right.
but also the details of Butch's face as he runs away
yeah.
towards the foreground are somewhat different, so
that's definitely the big selling one. And also, I think to a certain extent, the S in particular becomes more prominent on the cover. As a matter of fact, the S itself on his chest is not really, it's that prominent in throughout the course of the issue.
Well, in that particular panel, the panel from which the cover is taken, it doesn't even appear to be there.
Right.
And you're right. Throughout the entire story here, it does take some squinting in order to make out in some panels that it is, in fact, an S. And in some, panels, no amount of squinting whatsoever appears to avail you that it is in fact an S.
It's funny, by the way, you should mention squinting, because the cover image, I think, has led a lot of people over a long time to sort of reinterpret what Superman's Golden Age costume looked like. Specifically this one, that there was a time in the 90s and I think in the early 2000s when DC was trying to make an effort to market that character, and when they did, they would give Superman almost these Romanesque boots that were, like, you know, red on the bottom but then had straps, red straps that went up blue leggings.
Okay.
Which, if you look at the cover as it stands, you don't really see it, because it's not, but if you zoom in real close, you get real close, you can almost see that there are straps there, but they're not colored right.
Okay.
So it's sort of a weird, it's led to a lot of interpretations of what his costume looks like. Also, if you look at the front cover again, the S, well, you know, it's a red S in a very definite yellow shield.
And it's not a diamond-shaped shield. No. It's almost like a police shield.
Right.
Sort of deal.
Yeah, but when you get into the comic itself, it's basically a yellow triangle with a.
Now
with
the straps on the straps on the boots thing actually makes sense to me, because I've heard on more than one occasion that when he designed, and I guess Jerry Siegel had some input too as the sort of co-creator, but that when, you know, he was visually designing, I mean, this is not a time. This was the first cape and tights,
right?
That we had seen, and this was sort of derived from, I've heard on numerous occasions that Joe Shuster derived that from Circus Strongmen.
Right.
So if that is in fact his origin, not his origin, but that's under
the inspiration.
If that is in fact the inspiration for it, then strap up Roman type sandals slash boots would actually make a lot of sense in that context.
No, very true. Very true.
So,
but, you know, it's eventually, though, they lost it, and I think that sort of helped over time. But so just to jump back real quick. So Lois and Clark's first date, this, for some strange, stupid reason, but one that helps the story move on, a gangster finds himself enamored with Lois, cuts in on Lois and Clark dancing. Lois gets really pissed off, slaps them both, and slaps the gangster rather, and leaves. The gangster decides to kidnap Lois. I'll teach her to not dance with me. Because, you know, if you're going to get in trouble for anything, that's really what you want to get in trouble for. Superman follows, rescues Lois for the first time, has that great panel of him almost lumbering over her, saying, you needn't be afraid of me, I won't harm you.
Which, yes.
When you think about it, for the very first time that you see someone who can do these things, this introduction, it was amazing. He, you know, he
you have to
leaps
do a lot
over
of mental work
car.
To sort of compensate for the amount of time and amount of stuff inspired by this that has passed since then.
Sure.
But you're right.
I mean, he leaps over a moving car, he lifts it over his head, he shakes everybody out, and he demolishes the car.
Including Lois. That shocked me. He picks up the car and shakes everybody out, including Lois.
Yeah. So this is actually a necessary point that, again, it sort of gets lost. The idea that you have this man who can do things, it's not something you've ever seen before. There's a reason that she could be afraid of him. So this is such a great thing. But then, of course, it leads to the most nonsensical, not the most nonsensical, but one of the most nonsensical points of this entire story. Earlier in the piece, the editor of the Daily Star, which is where, not the Daily Planet, the Daily Star, gives Clark Kent the assignment, have you ever heard of Superman? I want you to check him out. Lois comes running in to say, I saw Superman, and the editor's response is, are you sure it wasn't pink elephants you saw?
I know. I think that's just the inherent sexism of the time.
Clearly.
Like, I know that Lois is supposed to be a reporter, but at this point she isn't like the crack investigative reporter that she would later be portrayed as. At this point, she says during the date, she says, please, Clark, I've been scribbling sob stories all day long. So she was really clearly more of an agony aunt kind of thing. And the fact that she had the job at the newspaper at all was sort of gender restricted in terms of her role. So the fact, oh, she's a woman, clearly she's hysterical because that's the way women are. This ain't Perry White yet.
No, it's true. As a matter of fact, it's, again, not written in stone, but this is the character who is eventually called George Tyler.
Right. Yes. Oh, and also it also needs to be pointed out that at this point, Jerry and Joe are still what? They're in their late teens right at this point. Yeah. So the fact of the matter is it's not like they had a tremendous life experience of women on which to draw for their portrayal of them in this comic.
So from here on in, the story just sort of peters out to a cliffhanger where Clark gets sent on assignment to go check out a possible, unrest in a certain part of the world. Instead, he decides to go inexplicably. He goes to Washington, D.C. instead. He's like, nah, screw that. I'm going to D.C.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how that got I think there was some sort of intelligence that he received about the conflict in San Monte. Like he gets sent to cover the conflict in South American Republic of San Monte, and I think that somewhere he gets some intelligence that has something to do with what's going on in Washington, but we don't see that or not given that information, so I don't know why he does that. But
yeah, he says, because literally all it says, Kent takes a train not toward San Monte, which by the way you can get to by train, but to Washington D.C. So good to know either way. So he winds up in D.C. where he finds himself uncovering corruption.
Political corruption.
And it ends
by a lobbyist. Let us once again just remind ourselves that this is an adventure comic aimed at apparently children, and they're giving them not just wife beating, not just women wrongly sent to the electric chair. We're also getting a a lobbyist corrupting a politician in a much more sleazy and, dare I say, realistic kind of way than would soon become the standard in comic books.
Absolutely. Seriously, the only thing that's missing here is like naked pictures, honestly.
I know, right? Yeah, blackmail.
So Superman grabs the corrupt gentleman, takes him for a run on electric lines, goes to leap to another building, and falls just a little short.
Yes.
And so begins the startling adventures of the most sensational strip character of all time, Superman. A proclamation that turned out to be so much more true than I think even they had any idea.
Yeah, no, that was the typical marketing hyperbole of the time. You know, it's actually a very, whenever I read this, I hark back to a novel I read not too long ago, well known to be inspired by the creation of Superman, the great novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon.
Yes.
And, it is a good novel. It gets very literary, especially in the second half, and doesn't maintain the pulpy, fanboy thrill of the early part, but the fact of the matter is that through either imagination or research, Chabon presents in the characters of Sam Clay and Joe Cavalier analogs to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster that are extremely believable. And so having read that novel, when I now read these very, very early adventures of Superman, it's very easy for me to sort of relate to and picture the people behind the scenes. And that's a very so basically, if you're a fan of this early golden age material, I would say at the very least the first half of the novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is very interesting, and I would say almost required reading. So,
all right, well, get on that, people.
There you
out
go.
There.
There you go.
But now, it only took, I guess, 13 months before they decided to tell his origin story again.
In the summer of 1939. Well, in Superman 1, which was cover dated summer of 1939, even in these early days, the cover dates were a couple of months ahead of the actual date that they hit newsstands.
Yes.
The points of distribution. But so this would probably have been April or May 1939. So let's call it a year later.
About a year later.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be Superman number one. The first time I guess a character of this kind had gotten his own book, based on his own with his name on the top. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it starts, it's very interesting to me, because whereas the origin, one-page origin in Action Number 1 begins with just this sort of, I won't say nondescript, it's very interesting and full of sort of pulpy, sci-fi, H.G. Wellsy kind of overtones, It is not a terribly distinctive, I suppose, panel, the panel of the rocket ship taking off and leaving the doomed planet of Superman's birth.
Right. The unnamed at that point.
The unnamed at that point. Now we get to the Superman number one, and the origin gets expanded to 2 pages, and it starts with not just a panel that names the planet, now it is the doomed planet Krypton,
yes,
but in fact also gives us one of the first and most iconic images in comic book history of this is the planet blowing up and the cigar-shaped rocket zooming away from it towards the viewer, as it were. And this, in with variations, that composition and that image will continue to represent the beginning of Superman's life pretty much up until this day, although I have no idea what they did with it in the New 52. But I'm saying, you go through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s,
hell, even
the 70s and 80s, that image is sort of the seed on which all others are built.
The ship sort of gets slightly, the shape of the ship ever changes slightly, maybe the colors a little bit, the planet in the background in varying stages of blowing up, but the composition just stays pretty much
exactly
like that.
Exactly. So now, we also get a little bit more expanded about his childhood.
Yes.
On the rest of page one, his rocket reaches our planet, and he's found by the Kents,
yes,
who are an elderly couple.
Yes, an elderly couple.
And that just got me wondering.
Yeah.
That just got me wondering. In comics,
yes,
right up until and through the 1960s, parents were always represented as ridiculously elderly. I mean, I always found it interesting, going over to my boy Spider-Man, the fact that Peter Parker was 15 years old and his Aunt May looked for all the world like, when he's 15, like she's in her 80s.
Yeah, she should have been Grandma May.
Yeah, so,
or
and
Grand
then
May,
even,
excuse me.
But even a little later, you've got, you know, he gets into college, so he's 18 and he's dating Gwen Stacy, and Gwen Stacy's father, Captain Stacy, I think his name was Ned Stacy, but I'm not sure. But Gwen's father, Captain Stacy, had white hair.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why parents were all, the creators of these decades all seem to make the choice to depict parents, even of young people, as very old.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you would think that it's a miracle that they lived to see his adolescence.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And then a couple
company.
Of panels later, they want to adopt that sweet child. We can't get that sweet child out of our mind. We've come to adopt him, if you'll permit us. And I'm wondering, did they allow people who are elderly to adopt in the 1930s? I don't know. Maybe they did.
Well,
but I'm just wondering, that age would be a count against them, I think.
Well, except in this particular instance, because as with the origin story in the
first one, that's true.
You get to see baby Superman holding furniture over his head, and so you do definitely get the impression that they want that child gone. Which,
no, that's true.
You know,
the guy actually says, "Phew, thank goodness they're taking him away before he wrecks the asylum."
Oh, which, by the way, this, the orphan asylum.
I know, it's
great,
not an orphanage anymore. That's a little weird, you know.
Yeah,
but
also, the notice the timing. This is before you see it, before it came to the point where, oh my God, I found a child who can lift furniture over his head, let me call the government. No,
yeah,
let's
exactly.
just get rid of him.
Let's just hoist him off on this clueless elderly couple.
Yes.
Like, that's down. This guy's a jackass.
He
but
really
anyway,
is, yes.
So now we see him raised by, you know, we get a panel of the Kents telling young Clark, he's still a child, but telling him, you have great strength, but you have to hide it from people or they'll be scared of you.
Right.
But you must, when the time comes, use it to assist humanity. So he's definitely being given this sort of moral code, this sort of urge to have a secret identity, a separate identity, Superman and Clark Kent, and also his moral code of, you know, using his strength to help humanity. Both of those are coming from his foster parents, the Kents. moving on to page two, we get several panels, whereas it was sort of one subdivided panel in Action Comics number one. Here we get five whole panels, really, of him discovering his powers. He can hurdle skyscrapers, leap an eighth of a mile, raise tremendous weights, run faster than a streamlined train, and once again, coming back to the phrase, and again, nothing, I want people to note, nothing less than a bursting shell could penetrate his skin.
Now, to be fair, only a year has passed, so there hasn't been any great need to upgrade it.
It hasn't been revised in any great way. It's more merely been expanded upon. We got the name of the planet. We got a few more scenes interjected. That's all fine. And then the Kents pass away. They are still just the Kents.
Yes. I would like to point out. What, Mrs. Kent got a name earlier.
That's true, because when they discover it, Pa Kent does in fact say, "Look, Mary.
Mary.
It's a child." Right, so it's Mary Kent, so that's fine. Yeah. And then they pass away, and that apparently it is the passing away of his foster parents that strengthened the determination Clark had to turn his titanic strength into channels that would benefit mankind. And once again, so was created Superman, Champion of the Oppressed, blah, blah, blah.
Now,
so,
in order to, by the way, before you continue, I would be remiss to point out that while, you know, he was on the verge of making an appearance at this point, or if he had slightly already made an appearance, Batman's origins would not be revealed until November of 1939.
Okay.
And so the idea that the death of his parents, the death of, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Kent, sort of galvanized him and made him, you know, it strengthened his resolve to become a force for good, technically predates, in the printed page, Batman's death of his parents, saying, I will avenge them and make sure, you know. I mean, so, it's a slightly different vow, but the image came technically first to Superman over Batman.
No, that's true. So Superman really is sort of originating the classic dead parents trope here.
Yeah.
That said, Batman does have the murdered parents trope.
True.
So
true.
That is a significant difference.
Yeah, well, Superman lost two sets of parents.
Okay, settle down. So anyway, we move on through Superman number one here, and we get more. We get him trying unsuccessfully to convince the editor of the Daily Star to give him a job as a reporter. So he's not yet a reporter,
right?
But he eavesdrops on a tip about a lynching about to happen at the county jail, and he goes and he breaks up the lynching.
Yes.
And from the guy who was going to get lynched.
Yes.
Which, okay, the fact that they are using a battering ram to break into the jail in order to lynch a guy who's already apparently slated for the electric chair, I'm not sort of getting this mob justice thing at all, but okay, whatever. the dude, Sims, I guess we later learn his name is.
Well, okay, keep going, because we're about to come up on something that I just don't get, but okay,
right,
keep going.
Right, so he tips Superman off to the fact that he's being held for the murder of Jack Kennedy.
Yeah,
but he didn't do it.
Yeah.
Evelyn Curry, who's going to be electrocuted tonight for it, didn't do it. In fact, it was the singer at the Hi-Lo Club. And we go on. But you said, now what doesn't make sense to you here?
Okay, where the hell, how many people are getting accused for this murder?
I know, right?
Evelyn Curry is facing the chair, but this mob seems to feel that Evelyn didn't do it, they don't care. This guy did it, so we're going to lynch him.
Or maybe they both did it, and the fact that this guy isn't going to the chair for it, although he's being held.
Right.
Like here, she's already been convicted and is heading to the chair. He's still in the county lockup for the same murder. You're right. This doesn't make sense whatsoever.
Bizarre.
But, you know, Clark gets the scoop. He convinces the editor to give him the job. And now he goes to confront the singer, B. Carroll, at the Hi-Lo Club. And sort of says, well, and he basically physically threatens her. He's like, she tries to shoot him. He squishes the gun and basically threatens to do the same to her if she doesn't sign the confession.
To which, by the way, she says, you're hurting me. So clearly he's holding
her.
Now,
I want to point out, though, a lot of people, I think, would take this opportunity to point out how much less nice Superman was in this early incarnation, so to speak, than he would later become, and that is a valid observation. But to me, what this really does is sort of paint a portrait of Superman as this very tough intimidating, very aggressive sort of character.
Right.
And to me, that makes the his urge to play the cowardly milquetoast as Clark Kent more valid, because he's really sort of creating that separation between Clark and Superman, and really like trying to set it up as a disguise. We're still at the point I made earlier where Superman is who he is and Clark is merely the disguise, but the fact this to me makes the quote-unquote disguise, makes unquote the cowardly air that he's putting on as Clark Kent make more sense than it does in later decades.
Right. I mean, as a man of action, yeah, that's one thing. I mean, there are levels of bravery that you can say. Like, look, honestly, I've always said that one of the bravest things that Superman does is he walks outside in tights.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
couldn't pay me enough to do that.
Right? So what you have is one of the great, to me, reinforcements of the secret identity was, you know, like, for example, if there was a superhero that kind of looked like you, but he wore tights, I would look at him and I'd look at you and I'd go, there's no way that I could imagine Brian wearing that. I don't care if he looks like Brian. Brian would not go out in tights. Yeah, I know him better than that. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, there are levels of bravery, but you're right. This is the starkest example of the difference between Clark Kent and Superman, is that yes, Superman is no nonsense. He gets right to the point.
He can be mean when he wants to be.
Well, intimidating.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, you know, that's the direction that he takes. What I find fascinating at this point is that this, to me, you could make an argument. I don't think that I necessarily would personally, but you could make the argument that there is absolutely a level of misogyny.
Oh yeah, totally.
That is an undercurrent now, thanks to all this, because you have a woman who clearly is the murderess, who will just, you know, use her wiles.
Yeah, you can almost hear that odd, that, I mean, there was something about the accent or the delivery of in films of the 30s and 40s that women had that, you know, and so you can really hear B. Carroll here go, yes, I killed Jack Kennedy and he deserved it, but you'll never tell anyone. You're not going to leave this room alive,
but,
you know.
Well, yeah, but what's the first thing once she figures it out is that you attract me. Couldn't we talk this over? Like, Jesus Christ. Okay, so you go from that to, yes, I'm going to shoot you, right? So, evil woman, right off the bat, who, by the way, we even set up in Action Comics 1 that there's an evil woman, even though we didn't get to find out just how evil. And then the next woman we meet is Lois.
Yes.
Who doesn't have time for the... Well, who actually charitably... goes out on a date with Clark.
I suppose
to get
I'll
pissed.
Give you a break
yeah.
for a change.
Right?
Yeah.
And so literally, there's kind of a anti thing going on here at some point. You just go, really? But, you know, that's really, again, so from this point.
It's a reprint largely of Action Comics number 1.
And 2, I believe, right? Because the story does
continue. Well, right,
continue.
The story actually continues here in Superman number 1.
But we're not into that's another.
These are reprints, but that's time for another.
Yeah.
So now that we have sort of now we get to the biggest leap in stylistic difference, because both Action Comics number 1 and the very pleasingly to me expanded version in Superman number 1 were created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Sure.
But now we move on to Superman number 53, which was cover dated July-August 1948.
10th anniversary issue.
It was the 10th anniversary issue, and they tout it as featuring the origin of Superman. They actually say, never before have we revealed the full origin of Superman, but also the style is extremely different. And according to the Grand Comics database, this was written by Bill Finger, the never properly appreciated during his lifetime, Bill Finger, also part of the whole Batman creation story.
Sure.
With art by Wayne Boring and Stan Kay, who were probably the preeminent Superman artists of the 1940s.
And I'll tell you something, it is a night and day difference from what we've just talked about. So just to give you a little idea, we get some world building first, finally. Mm-hmm. We finally get a little bit of taste of what life is like on Krypton. And what do we find out about Krypton? We find out that the seemingly troubled couple is upset because Junior is 4 years old in the third grade and doesn't know calculus.
Yes, I know. Well, that is a very sort of ham-fisted but effective way to illustrate the point that's made in the narration of that panel of how humans of Krypton had high intelligence and magnificent physical perfection.
It's true. Also, as part of the world building, we do learn through ancillary means that some of Superman's powers actually come from Krypton, meaning on Krypton he would still have them. Hence the fact that one Kryptonian says to another, oh, look at those people of Earth, they don't even have X-ray vision.
Yes. Now, wait, I like this bit, though, in that particular panel. The Kryptonian scientist said, if our astro calculations are correct, a Kryptonian on planet Earth could take a normal step and leap over its tallest building, which is merely a calculation of weight and gravity. So really, guys, I don't know what you're doing up there on Krypton, but really a normal calculation could have accomplished that. You really didn't need astro calculation to get there.
Also, let's be clear about that as a visual. Are they do they have the Ministry of Silly Walks? Is that the kind of steps they take so that you can negotiate a walk? Just saying.
Okay, so
in this issue, both Jor-El and Lara, Superman's parents, are named and named properly. Yes. Even though Jor-El was first named back in 1939 in a newspaper strip, and the name was spelled slightly differently.
Oh, it was. I was going to ask, was this the first time we got the names Jor-El and Lara, but it was the second time we got the name Jor-El, right?
Jor-El was initially in 1939 newspaper strip. They finally dropped his name, but it was J-O-R dash just the letter L.
L, okay, that's fair.
Eventually, there was a novel that was written based on essentially the newspaper strips and the comic strips. And in that book, it was spelled J-O-R-E-L, but the E was lowercase. And finally, over time, it evolved and got the uppercase treatment, and this is where we finally got it. Although...
I would just like to, before we...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, before we get to the domestic drama of Jor-El and Lara, we have Jor-El attempting, you know, very famous scene, and this is, I think, the first time that this very iconic scene of Jor-El attempting to convince the elite of Krypton that their planet is doomed and being laughed down. That's so iconic it made it into the Donner movie, obviously.
Sure.
I think this is the first time that we so could we say that scene came from the mind of Bill Finger?
Well, no, because I think ultimately this is the first time I think it appears in the comic books. Mm-hmm. But again, going back to the world building that was done, you know, when Superman first hit the comic strips, the newspaper strips, they were able to expand on the origin story a bit.
So a lot and of I think this stuff came out of the newspaper strips.
Sure, because again, if you look back at, say, the Superman serials, mm-hmm. which clearly predated this, I think, or at least were around the same time the same scene takes place.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
And it's funny because they're all almost done word for word. So I want to say it's possible that in 39 when the strip showed up and Jor-El first showed up there, I think that's when it started to show. But what's fascinating about this scene as portrayed here mm-hmm. is that this is the first time I think that, you know, again, in the comic books we're seeing Jor-El. Mm-hmm. Jor-El does not look the way we're accustomed to him looking for later years. As a matter of fact, if you strip it down, in this instance, Jor-El's costume looks very much like Robin the Boy Wonder.
Really? Well, it is with the red and the green, yes.
No, red breast, green sleeves, yellow cape.
Okay, that's fair.
Whereas later on, Jor-El's complete suit was green. It had, in this case, it has, it has a red Saturn inside of a yellow circle.
Yeah, ringed planet sort of deal.
As opposed to later on, it's sort of a yellow circle with a red star. You know, and so these little, of course he does have, though, thank God for this, his characteristic headband.
Yes,
because
the headband.
He wore it before Rambo did, and it was so fashionable on Krypton then.
Well, I have two observations. One, I'm going to have a later observation about the coloring in this issue.
Sure.
That you note the coloring of Jor-El's costume. This is still, in 1948, we were still at least, by my calculations, 25 years away from colorists first getting credit in a in comic book credits.
Sure.
So I think it was often the case, often the practice for inkers to color their work. So it's possible that Stan Kay colored this, but we do not know if it was Stan Kay or if it was a house colorist. I'm just pointing that out because I will have a color issue later, slightly later on in this issue. However,
yes.
The other thing I want to point out is here in the Council of Five in the Hall of Wisdom,
yes.
later on when Jor-El says that they have to build giant rocket ships and migrate to a world with an atmosphere like Krypton's of the planet Earth,
right.
one of the council scoffs, and I quote, "Ha ha, we have observed Earth people with our astrotelescopes."
Yes.
Or your regular telescope.
No, no, regular telescopes, the light wouldn't have reached Krypton in time for them to see what's going on. So you need these astro telescopes that, again, Lord only knows how the hell they work.
Well, no. I think that unbeknownst to whoever, to Bill Finger and the writer here,
sure.
I think, in fact, he meant it the way he read it, because they said, we have observed Earth people with our astro telescopes. They are thousands of eons behind us mentally and physically. No, that's just how long it took the light
yeah.
to get to you.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, what you're looking at are Neanderthals.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sorry, it hasn't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah, so moving on. Sorry, so now we get Jor-El and Laura.
Which brings us to the next panel, which I think is this incredible leap of logic that the council has.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How do we know that Jor-El is not trying to frighten Krypton's leaders away from our planet so that he may rule?
Yeah, that is a real – that's a tin hat conspiracy theory if ever I heard one.
I mean, this is one heck of a ploy he's got.
This is the Hall of Wisdom.
It's really, I mean, good grief. I want to take over the planet, so I'm going to come up with this incredible scheme. Also, by the way, of note, you want to talk about, again, we sort of mentioned this before, that it's that the origins of Superman are a product very much of their times. Listen to this explanation. The core of Krypton is composed of a substance called uranium.
I know that.
Which for untold ages has been setting up a cycle of chain impulses building in. Okay. Soon, very soon, every atom of Krypton will explode in one final terrible blast. Gentlemen, Krypton is one gigantic atomic bomb. Where the hell did that come from?
Well, that's very much, it's the late 40s. The
right.
cold, the arms race has just begun. We're only 3 years removed from the. From the first, you know, from the atomic bombs in Japan.
Yep.
And so, yeah, all this is this is the zeitgeist of the time. This is what is currently the fears and concerns and latest scientific learning of the people creating this, sort of trying to make it, quote unquote, topical after a fashion. So
now
I had less of a problem. Sorry, I was just going to say, even as wonky as that goes, as far as like scientific explanations for things goes, that is Stephen Hawking next to the violence that Stan Lee would do to every conceivable scientific topic in the course of the 1960s. Enough said.
Well played, sir. Which, by the way, I wasn't trying to say that I necessarily have a problem with it, but it's just such a glaring piece. Where you go, okay, I can tell you exactly when this was written because look at that.
Yes.
That came out of nowhere. Okay, so we get a little bit more as time goes on. We get to see the ship leave again. The exploded planet Krypton, composition, explosion in the background, rocket ship coming in, right?
Yes, that is a great – we got a slightly different bit of that in the splash panel on page one of this story over Superman's mopey head.
Yeah.
I don't think we are ever exactly told why he's moping here, but okay, I mean, we can sort of make the leap of logic that it's mourning for his lost homeworld and everything.
Sure.
But that said, we get a slightly different version of that iconic image. But this one here on page six is truly like my favorite iteration of it yet.
The rocket ship comes to Earth, lands softly.
And here is my coloring issue.
Yes.
I know that we had not yet put up satellites into orbit yet, okay? So I understand that we didn't really have the iconic blue marble image in our cultural minds yet. I get that. But under what pretext or by what thinking did whoever colored this issue decide to make the oceans orange?
Orange. It's an entirely golden planet. And
as
by the way,
rocket ship zooms towards Earth, Earth has green continents and orange seas. I don't understand.
Can I ask you also, how did we get two suns?
Yes, yes. I suppose one of those is meant to be the sun and the other the moon, but...
But they're the same color, you see.
Yes, which I know. Okay,
slightly,
so fair enough.
A problem. So, rocket ship lands safely on and gently on this really strangely hued planet that we come to know as Earth, right past this really old jalopy.
Yeah, now here's – I'm torn here because on the one hand, I like the fact that they're driving this – like seriously, this is like a 1904 era Ford. But I'm thinking if this was published in 1948, then you have to think that Superman probably, if he crashes on Earth as an infant, probably crashes around what – based on what I see in the comics of this era, probably around 1918, 1930. 20.
Yeah, I would go
so actually, 20, the jalopy goes with that. However, in this particular panel, we also see in the distance
a great
modern
city. Yeah.
Mega city of the kind they would not have had in 1918, 1920. So I'm really kind of confused by this panel.
Well, if anything, I guess you could say that they're old folks who have an old car that they can't afford more because they because also let's look at where they're driving.
Decent, poor folk.
They're literally driving in the middle of nowhere. They're not even driving on a road. They're just driving.
Yeah.
And so, wow, there's a baby inside. The good news is this was the first time that we decided to settle what the hell did the Kents do with the rocket, because the rocket consumes itself because the metals and materials are not they're foreign to Earth's, I love this, climatic and chemical makeup. So they burst into flames, which begs the question, if you really think about it, so why didn't the baby burst into flames?
Yes. I would also like to point out, apropos of the conversation we were having earlier, that in this particular iteration,
it is Aunt May.
Ma Kent in particular looks astoundingly elderly. Like this is spinsterhood.
Yeah, this is Aunt May just picked up the young baby. So they now again no longer they're not named at this point. So in this particular instance, if you squint, you could actually get away with not necessarily knowing whether or not these are really the Kents or just a passing couple who happened to find the baby and take them to the orphanage. So where it's not an asylum now, it's a home for foundlings.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So that is our third iteration in as many issues.
So the good news is, though, because the rocket ship exploded and consumed itself, as it were, they don't have to explain where the baby came from. They can't explain it because they say, if we tell, who's going to believe us? Good question. We don't have proof. So they drop the kid off, and now we have taken a slight quantum leap with regards to the baby's abilities. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Superman's powers, by most accounts I've read, had been growing and being added to for like 10 years at this point.
No, but I'm just talking about, remember, we had two solid comics 1 year apart that said that when he reached maturity,
That is absolutely true.
The most we got was in the orphanage, he held a piece of heavy furniture over
his head.
He had
great strength.
Yeah. Here, he lifts an attendant over his head. He breaks toys left and right. No needles are breaking his skin. And he's not necessarily flying, but certainly leaping up to the ceiling.
Or possibly flying. I'm not sure exactly
it's
how they intended
to tell.
It.
Because there's a lot of stuff going on in the air. There's the swishes around him. So I honestly at first thought he flew up, but it's hard to tell. At either point, unless that couple, Mr. and Mrs. Kent, if we could push the adoption papers through quickly, get rid of them again. So yay, we've learned at this point that all of these adoption people are bastards. And instead of trying to take care of the kid, they just want to foist him on an unsuspecting couple. But we also get a little piece of lore here. I don't know necessarily if this is the first time. Maybe it had brought up in one of the other pieces of media. But we finally get to know in comicdom that Clark is named after his mother's family.
Yes, indeed.
So, yay that. We get through a few more pages that essentially replicate what we'd seen before. He's faster than a train, leaping a building, blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, X-ray vision. Good to know. And then,
well, they did say in Superman number one back in 1939 that Kryptonians had X-ray vision.
No, that was earlier in this.
Oh, that was earlier in this. I'm sorry, I know.
It just seems like 10 years ago, but it was actually earlier in this one.
Bleeding together.
So, unfortunate. But the good news is, on the very next page, they actually do something that makes a tremendous amount of sense. They kill off Ma Kent before Pa Kent, thank God, because Ma Kent looked like she was dying when they found the kid.
I know, so, and now it's got to be like 20-some-odd years later.
And now Pa Kent decides he has to tell his... You must! There are evil people out there, and you got to do it. And not only does he give him his mission, but he gives him a name.
Right.
Superman.
He says, you must hide your true identity. He never says why. He just says that he must.
Yeah.
They must never know Clark Kent is a Superman. Remember, because that's what you are. A Superman.
And there
did
we
I mention
go.
Superman?
Superman.
And, Superman, son. Superman.
Okay.
Sorry.
Pa, are you okay? He's dead. Okay. So, and then standing over. So, if you look carefully, though they aren't. They're not really mentioned much beforehand. We do get finally John, J-O-H-N, and Mary Kent on the
John and Mary, really?
Yeah.
Like the most generic names imaginable.
Well,
however, now that does beg the question, though. You being our resident Superman expert, hence this podcast's existence, I wonder when were they first named Jonathan and Martha? Because that's the name I know Superman's parents.
Yes. Well, I think that came about probably even just on the next go-round, more or less.
So like the 50s?
Yeah.
Silver Age?
Because honestly, John and Mary, at this point, was one of two sets of popularly accepted names for the Kents.
Uh-huh.
The other one, it was Sarah and Eben Kent.
Really? And where did that come from?
I believe that came from that book.
The novel.
The novel. And so, as a matter of fact, that even made it into, I want to say, I think it was the Superman serial, Sarah and Eben Kent, that they actually had that name there as well, like in an actual other form of media. The fact that John and Mary sort of snuck back in there, and then eventually it got morphed. Jonathan, which actually lost the H, so it was J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, and Martha. I think at some point everyone just said, this is a little too on the nose, really, So, and then he became Superman, and there he is standing resplendent, arms akimbo on the last
akimbo,
page.
Yes.
Saying, here I am, this is my classic Superman pose.
And you can almost hear the classic 1950s horn fanfare theme from the TV serial.
Right, which, honestly, was probably, it's funny, the music of Superman sort of morphs a bit, too, because for a while... there was the arrangement, I want to say it was by Sammy Timberg, that was in the Max Fleischer cartoons that Dion and I are watching. But it's also wound up being for a while played by organ for the radio show. So the Adventures of Superman, the serials starring Kirk Allen, were the first departure from that musical style, followed by the Adventures of Superman TV show, which I think had the better. Theme to it, stronger theme. But that's, we're getting into other media. So, we now have three sets. What do you think of this origin here? This is, because this, I think, is the closest, this is probably the closest to being the true foundation of what became the rest of his origin, like for the rest of time.
I like it because, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, because on the one hand, I do like it. But on the other hand, like I said earlier, when you grew up in the last half of the 20th century, Superman was a part of the cultural fabric of the world that you lived in. So it was very hard to be a young man of a certain mindset and reach maturity without becoming aware in some way, shape, or form of the Superman and his backstory to a certain extent. So the fact, it's very interesting to me how you get the one page origin in Action Comics, and it's like bits of what you think you know, but a lot of what you think you know is missing.
Right.
And then you get and a couple of details are different. Then you get the two page origin in Superman number one, which doesn't, like I say, contradict or undermine the Action Comics origin in any way, but expands upon it in an interesting way. And then you get this, which definitely sort of tweaks certain details a little, I guess, to accommodate changes to Superman's basic mythos that had taken place in the 10 years since.
Sure.
But still, it's still generally the same bones of the story.
Yeah.
And you've got it's so similar to what, you know, I know that it's you're sort of connecting dots from a very embryonic proto-origin in Action Comics here to this very relatively fully fleshed out and familiar origin tale. And it's interesting to see it grow and inflate and become mature in that way.
It's so funny to me because, you know, this is not by far, this final origin, it's not by far my favorite by any stretch, but it does sort of demonstrate that, yes, this is the one. This is what everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
And it also goes to show you, to me, again, it's been 10 years. We've expanded on this origin tremendously, but let's look at exactly how much real estate Krypton is taking up.
Mm-hmm.
Krypton, you get a lot of pages here, but if you read them, they are all geared toward probably two goals. One, to explain where his powers came from.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You get to find out that they were so advanced and the kids are really smart and they have X-ray vision and blah, 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 and we have all this technology, blah, 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 blah. Sets that up, and then so it sets up how he has his powers, and it basically just sets up where he came from.
Yeah.
And that is it.
Yeah.
That is the sole, and I mean, like I said, we got pages and pages and pages. We got, what, 3-4 pages of Krypton here.
Mm-hmm.
But
six,
that's
actually.
Six.
Well, five.
Okay.
The first page is the splash page.
Okay. And those are all geared. I mean, you could have spent some serious time doing other stuff. Instead, it's literally to set really up where he came from and why he has powers. And that's
yep.
it. And also to the point where, guess what doesn't show up in this issue? I don't know. Let's see if you noticed it. We have 5 pages of Krypton. What does not show up in those 5 pages?
The Phantom Zone?
Good guess. Good.
The Bottle City of Kandor.
Yes, something more important.
Superman's name.
Correct.
Thank you for reminding me, because I was going to ask you that as well. Where was the name Kal-El first uttered?
I swear to God, I spent a lot of time after reading this issue trying to find the answer to that question. And by the way, you'd be surprised how many things and other people have been named Kal-El.
Mm-hmm.
Google is not forthcoming with that, and neither is the DC Wikipedia or any other of the sources. Finding out when Jor-El was first mentioned, child's play. Kal-El, a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And so, to my mind, I don't know if by this point the name had been invented yet or used, but this is the issue that purports to tell you, for at long last, the origin of Superman, and at no point did they think it was important to say his name.
Right. That's
so
true. His name is Clark
yeah,
Kent.
Yeah. So
it's entirely possible
yeah.
in this presentation of his origin story, it's entirely believable to me that he was a newborn.
Yeah.
He was a newborn, and all of Jor-El's time was taken up with A, was consumed with A, the awareness that Krypton was about to blow up like a giant atomic bomb,
right.
And B, his desire to get his wife and in his and his child and in his mind his wife as well,
right.
Off the planet. So I find it very believable that at no point in all of that, given that the kid had been probably sure. born mere days before, which begs the question, how is Lara up and about so quickly? But
well, remember, they're far in advanced.
That's also true. But I guess the point I'm making is that it would be very believable to me if you said to me in this presentation of the story that they just hadn't named him yet.
Correct. And but I think the point that this brings me to is that, again, that's how important they all found Krypton to be, honestly. Mm-hmm. To Superman's mm-hmm. origin. It's not. So in later years, when, you know, greater emphasis is being put on it and greater desires are being put on it, you mm-hmm. know, ultimately, sure, fine, but I think the powers that were, the ones that were all around for the embryonic stages of the character, would probably all tell you that when push comes to shove, it's not that important.
Well,
it's a story device to explain why he's Superman.
No, I agree with you entirely, but it also needs to get pointed out that powers that be, so to speak, do change. Remember, in the first two origins that we got, the creators were Siegel and Shuster, and right. Vincent Sullivan was, I believe, the editor of Name. Anyway, here, now we're 10 years later, but now it's Bill Finger and Wayne Boring, and right. Mort Weisinger is at this point the editor.
But what I'm saying is, still by this point, like I said, if there was more than enough space,
no, right,
you could have injected more story. That wasn't the desire on everyone's part in telling the story was literally to get past it.
No, that's absolutely fair. I agree with that. I'm just saying it's not like the bunch of people who made the decision here in 1948 that that Krypton was still not that important.
Right.
Had any special right. pride of place in terms of authority over the mythos, because they weren't the original creators. So I agree completely with what you're saying, but I'm saying if a later creative team decided that Krypton was more important, to me that's allowable as well.
No, that's true, but I think that again, I've found that I think you can overemphasize it.
Oh, perhaps.
I mean, you can tell stories of Krypton, that's fine, but you know, as far as how it connects personally to Superman, I think there's a breaking point.
No, sure, sure.
But and that leads us to this month's Planet Editorial.
Oh,
I'm so excited. Uh-huh. So this month, I've been doing some thinking. We sat down, we read three origin stories, mm-hmm. you know, the first two within the first year of the character, and then the second one 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And it led me to an interesting conclusion, which is that...
I'll be the judge of that.
Yes. Yes, you will.
It could be a boring conclusion.
It is. It very well could be. And that is that if the very first story that I read was, in fact, the 1938 origin story, if I had read that when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would have gone back.
Interesting.
If I had read the 1939 origin story, I'm still not necessarily convinced I would have gone back.
Mm-hmm.
The 1948 origin story is a standalone. It has numerous pages long. However, it's geared towards being just an origin story. So that big reveal at the end, hey, he's Superman, it works as an origin story, but if you have no prior knowledge of the character, mm-hmm. There's no payoff. So the question to me becomes, you know, it brings me back to the idea that the origin stories, by necessity, they have to evolve. Mm-hmm. They have to grow. They have to appeal to the readership of the time. It's one of the saddest, yes. hardest lessons I've had to learn as a Superman fan.
Mm-hmm. Because, as a comic fan in general, sure. we've had many conversations about the the fact that it's okay and even desirable for any character franchise story that runs for this long to occasionally reboot, recalibrate, orient itself to remain relevant and accessible to the new audience. Absolutely. We've had that conversation in the past, and I agree with you.
I mean, I enjoy, I mean, this origin story, the 1948 origin story.
I think I might have stuck around if this one. I agree with you about the 38 and 39 ones, given who I am.
Right.
I don't know that I would have remained, that I would have found those interesting enough to go back for a second bite of that apple, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But the 48 origin story, I think I would have been very into as a kid. I would have wanted to read the next issue of this comic book story.
Well, I think if the story would have continued, I would have said yes. You know, I think that's what it's missing. And I think for many, you know, what they did at least one of these a decade from this point on. So they'd always retell the origin story and update it a little bit. And for each of those updates, it literally was just telling you the origin story.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually when they introduced Superboy into the mix, you know, they would add that time in there.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't spend any time with Superboy per se. You just got the highlights, as you should in an origin story. And I think the first time I encountered, and you got to be my gatekeeper on this one because I'm merely making a point.
Okay.
The first time I encountered an origin story that took us past the origin was in 1986 when John Byrne did the six-issue Man of Steel.
Yes. Yep.
You got the origin story, and then you continued to the next.
Right.
It was a six-part series. You had time to do that. But, you know, then we go on to other ones. There was Birthright. There was all this. And clearly these are necessary ideas to update an origin story. But I think what I take away from it is that starting in 1948, leading all the way up, at least in my mind, into the 80s, maybe even the 90s, is that the origin story, the basic origin story itself, with very little exception, remained completely intact. You know, I mean, sure, again, 86 was a turning point, but even, okay, so let's say from 48 to 78, this was it. You could read, the art would change a little bit, the page count might change a little bit, but part and parcel, this was the story you got.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, to me, I guess, there's a long stretch of his time to which I was okay with that kind of stuff. You know, that I felt that his origin was being updated to keep it hip with the times, but not at the expense of the character.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that.
And I guess if I have one piece of advice I could give to those in charge is that it's not a crime to hold on to some of what came before.
Yeah.
You know, and the spirit in which it was created. And change for change's sake is not always a good thing. You know, just look, he endured for that long.
Yeah, that's true. And we'll always have Krypton.
Right.
We will always have Krypton.
Including that, did you hear about the upcoming possible prequel series that's in the works, TV show?
Oh, that they're thinking of giving us something set on Krypton?
On Krypton, I think two generations before Jor-El.
Oh.
I think it's going to be called Krypton, which means that we can look forward to more penis-shaped ships like the ones we saw in Man of Steel.
Excellent. Okay, then.
Yes. How wonderful for all of us. any parting thoughts, Mr. Zeno?
Just it's good to read this stuff. I think I'm going to enjoy doing this podcast with you because I always like it. Like I said, this applies mostly to the 1948 issue, less so to the 38 and 39 issues. But it's always fun to go back and read something of historical significance that you knew of for a long time, that is very far removed from you in terms of time and in terms of cultural standards, and to read it and actually kind of genuinely enjoy it on its own terms, as well as from a more removed intellectual standpoint. So thank you for giving me the excuse to read these issues and add them to my mental memory box.
Well, I swear we will make a Superman fan out of you yet. So on our way out, I would just again would like to thank Brian for coming over to our neck of the woods, the Planet Podcast.
Pleasure.
And a reminder that, again, aside from hearing Brian here, you can catch him on the Mothership, the Podwits Podcast over at podwits.com. For Color Fanboys,
Fourcolor.podwitz.com.
Wahoo.
At furycast.podwitz.com. All of them also on iTunes.
Any place else that I'm missing? Like, are you?
No, I think that's about it. I think. Don't you think that's enough?
No, honestly, I think that you believe it or not. I already got the letter from my attorney saying that they want to change the Podwitz Podcast Network to the Xenobot, podcast network because you just need a few more shows.
It has been brought to my attention that there is a 15-minute stretch of my morning during which I am not podcasting. Yeah. So clearly, that chink in the armor needs to be filled. So
starting next month, it'll be the Xeno Shower podcast.
Yes, exactly.
You can listen to him lather up. It'll be fun.
And that's a little gross, but okay.
So, Brian, again, thank you for joining us on the Planet Podcast. I hope you guys at home enjoy
it.
Next time, absolutely. We look into the rich, rich history of the Man of Steel. 77 years almost. It's there's a lot out there. So keep looking at the skies. We'll see you. We'll hear from you next time on the Planet Podcast.
Can't get enough of the Podwitz? Well, why not check out the Podwitz specials? Into the Toy Box looks at the toys of our youth. The Year in Rehu sums up the last season of Doctor Who. There's an exclusive two-part special with Randy Jurgensen, former NYPD detective and Hollywood veteran. Shattered Hulls takes a look at nautical disasters from the past 100 years. Stories from the Utility Belt to the Batmobile looks at Batman's history in popular media. And Superheroes on Celluloid checks out the transition from superhero in comics to film. But don't forget the latest adventure, Cartoons. Yes, the Podwitz speak about their favourite tunes from years gone by. Go to podwitz.com or iTunes to subscribe to the best damn podcast out there.